Support comes from Empower Missouri, working to fight poverty and secure basic human needs and equal justice through coalition building and advocacy. Information about involvement at empowermissouri.org/action.
After a series of starts, stops, twists, turns, and loop-de-loops, Governor Eric Greitens finally got his wish last week when his appointees to the Missouri Board of Education dismissed Margie Van Deven. Since the legislature adjourned in May, Greitens made a series of appointments to the State Education Board. Some were removed because they refused to fire the education commissioner, while at least one, former Senator Delbert Scott, was ineligible to serve. But last week, Greitens finally got five of his appointees to agree on Van Deven's exit. In remarks to the media, Van Deven lamented on what she felt was a politicized process to remove her from her post.
The job of commissioner in Missouri is traditionally not a political role. But at the moment, political forces are eclipsing educational decisions. And although I didn't come to Jefferson City to fight, I'm willing to fight for children and teachers.
During his gubernatorial campaign, Greitens specifically rejected then-Governor Jay Nixon's line in the sand to veto any bill that provided public aid to private schools. He also got behind an unsuccessful effort this year in the legislature to expand charter schools, which was deeply unpopular among rural and suburban administrators. Eddie Justice, a Greitens appointee who voted to oust Van Deven, said the personnel move was necessary to improve the standing of Missouri schools.
I think we need to change the culture in our education bureaucracy in the state of Missouri, and the way you effectively begin to change the culture is to change the leadership.
Longtime state board member Mike Jones disagreed.
This board has lost its legitimacy as a governing body. I think this board today forfeited its right to ask for your cooperation in implementing public policy.
On this episode of the Politically Speaking podcast, we talk with Democratic State Representative Gina Mitten about how legislators may respond to the turmoil at the Department of Elementary and Secondary Education. We also chat with the Richmond Heights Democrat about her party's agenda in next year's legislative session. So let's hit the music.
This is the Politically Speaking podcast, a candid conversation with the Show Me State's biggest political newsmakers.
I'm Jason Mersenbaum.
And I'm Joe Manis.
That's Eric Greitens, Navy SEALs running for governor, and I'm really, really glad to be on with you, Jason and Joe.
I'm going to push back on these regulators.
I'm doing this for the people.
I was encouraged along the way, not just by my family, but by a lot of teachers and professors, and knew when I was in college that I would run for office someday.
We're very excited about the prospect of having some more free market solutions.
Even though after the conversation, I still might not agree.
We want our listeners to get a real sense of what drives these people.
They're actually people with a story to tell.
And welcome to Politically Speaking, the only show about Missouri politics featuring a co-host who will never see another Transformers movie again until Michael Bay personally apologizes to him for Transformers 2. I am that co-host, St. Louis Public Radio interim political editor Jason Rosenbaum. Joining me in studio today is
Joe Manis, who is drinking her last Diet Lime Coke, in existence until they start reproduction, which I'm told is going to be soon, but I'm...
For fans of our show who listened to Joe's plight the last time, it is a tragedy of epic proportions.
Yes, it is.
And joining us in studio for the second time, the assistant minority leader for the Missouri House.
Gina Mitten, state representative.
And just remind our listeners what your district encompasses.
My district is the 83rd district. So all of Maplewood, all of Rock Hill, portions of Richmond Heights where I actually live, portions of Webster Groves, almost all of Brentwood, and then a third of my voters are in the city of St. Louis in parts of the 24th, 23rd, and 10th Ward, or roughly the Clifton Heights, Ellendale, Franz Park neighborhood.
And I don't mean this as a sign of disrespect because I'm in your district every day, but it is one of the weirdest drawn districts in the entire state. I have no clue what the judges were thinking when they drew that. They might have been drinking a Diet Coke with lime when they did it.
That's actually true.
No. If they did it, if they were drinking Diet Coke with lime, they would have made no mistake.
But we'll avoid that discussion for now because we have a lot to talk about. One of the reasons we wanted to have Representative Mitten on the show is because there's been major developments at the Missouri Department of Elementary and Secondary Education. As we heard at the beginning of the show, Margie Van Deven is out as the commissioner of education. It's caused a lot of controversy. And I want to make clear before we start the show, it's not only Democrats who are upset with the governor, it's Republicans too. So I don't want to make this discussion a Republican versus Democratic thing, because there's been bipartisan scorn for this, and there's been some praise mainly on the Republican side. So with that as a backdrop, what was your reaction over the last few weeks when this entire process unfolded? Because it was quite messy.
Well, let's see. If my math is correct, I think that it took 10 attempts from the governor to make appointments to stick for five members that would ultimately be the five that voted to oust Commissioner Van Dieven on what was that, last Friday, I guess.
Last Friday, yes.
So that obviously, first and foremost, is a concern. I think that, you know, there are provisions in statute that would indicate that the removal of some of these members who had been sworn in and acted in their capacity as commissioners on the State Board of Education and were later removed for no cause, just sort of bumped off. There is certainly legal controversy about that, a lawsuit pending about that. But ultimately, at the end of the day, he did manage to get five members that were willing to oust a commissioner that was well-liked in a bipartisan fashion.
I actually talked to one of the board members that voted to oust Van Dieven today. His name is Eddie Justice. He's from Poplar Bluff. He's been active in Republican politics for many years in Southeast Missouri. I asked him directly what was the rationale for dismissing Van Dieven. This is what he told me.
I can't speak for the other members. They all have their own motives, I'm sure. My motives are pretty simple. I believe that the culture of our education bureaucracy in Missouri needs to change, and in order for that to change, we need new leadership. Over 60% of Missouri's fourth and eighth graders cannot read proficiently. That is unacceptable, and to accept that is to accept the status quo. There are a lot of future indicators based on those numbers, some of which include our economic future, as well as the future of and numbers of people we incarcerate. So we have got to get to a point where we're doing a better job of teaching our children to read. And those numbers of proficiency are not just limited to reading, but are go across the board, whether it's social studies or math or science. We just aren't cutting the mustard right now.
So I know education holds a dear place in your heart. Your husband is actually on the school board at Maplewood Richmond Heights, which has, I think, improved dramatically in its test scores over the last few years and is becoming one of the most desirable school districts in the entire region. When you hear something like that, what's your reaction?
Well, I think that there's a number of – I think there's a number of issues. And first and foremost is obviously if – you know. Having those that figure, and honestly, I can't off the top of my head confirm whether that's true or not. Every Missourian wants to make sure that we have a good public education system. Every parent and wants to make sure that their children are able to go to public school and be well educated. However, one of the things that that comment doesn't even address is the fact that poverty is one of the biggest factors in determining a child's success at school. And it's not whether or not Commissioner Van Dieven whether or not Ms. Van Dieven is or was the commissioner, but poverty. So until we address that and frankly look at the wraparound services that are needed in every public school district, the status quo is going to remain. It's not about the bureaucracy. It's about attacking the problem.
Well, one of the governor's chief objectives, and I'm not taking sides here, is that he wants someone who is more amenable to charter schools and to vouchers. Now, that is a very hot topic, especially among rural Republicans who aren't keen on that because they don't have there aren't enough people there to have those kinds of schools.
Right.
And so they're big on their public schools. So they see this as taking money away from the public schools, which is similar to what some critics say in the urban areas. The backdrop is I noticed that the board member did not mention those things. From your take, what are you hearing? Do you think the governor is going to be, A, bringing up some legislation that is tied to those issues during the next session and tying this to these percentages and his change in the state board? Or are there other things? I'm trying to get a handle of what his next step is.
Well, I don't think that anybody knows with the governor. So, with that backdrop, look, we've seen charter school expansion bills, I think, every single year since I've been in the legislature, and I'm sure every single year for years before that. So the desire to expand charter schools statewide is not going to go away, and this is going to exacerbate the issues as far as I'm concerned. If I remember correctly, last year, the charter school expansion bill passed the House with one vote to spare.
I think it was earlier this year, still 2017. Oh,
I guess that's right, last legislative session.
I make that mistake all the time because it feels like May was 10 years ago at this point, but continue.
Yes, fair enough. So yes, in the 2017 legislative session, if memory serves, the charter school expansion bill passed with one vote. And if I remember correctly also, those weren't easy votes to get, let's put it that way. I believe that the board was actually open for a little bit in order to make sure that everybody was there and able to push their cast their vote. But it went nowhere in the Senate. And given the shenanigans, and I think I've used that hashtag on this subject more than once, to sort of stop the shenanigans. But given the shenanigans that have gone on from the governor's office about the removal of Ms. Van Deven, I don't see the Senate having any greater appetite for that this year.
I want to play another clip from Eddie Justice because I asked him what influence the governor had on his vote. It's a pretty long clip because there's a follow-up question, but I wanted to make sure that the context was there. Here is more of my conversation with Mr. Justice.
I was never asked to vote any particular way. I was never pressured to do anything, and my appointment came with no conditions. I knew that our education system needed to be improved, and I knew that the culture of our educational bureaucracy needed to change. And I firmly believe that when those factors are needed to change, that leadership is usually the best place to start. Like I said before, I was never given any conditions on my appointment. And I did what I thought was best for Missouri's children and for our educational system. And, the governor never had to come to me and ask me to do anything, nor did he, or any of his staff.
There were several other appointees that were either removed or voluntarily resigned because they said that they didn't agree with this decision to get rid of Van Deven. Doesn't that suggest that the governor did have a role in this entire situation?
I don't think that it's my place to comment on that specifically because I wasn't there. I can only talk about my personal experience with the governor and the governor's office. I don't necessarily think that there is a problem if there had been conversations, because obviously no governor wants to appoint somebody who's going to directly counter what he believes is the correct direction for Missouri in education or any other department for that matter. When the governor is held accountable for the quality of education in Missouri during his tenure, it's obvious that he should have some say in who's making the decisions. How much say is more up to other people than me and with people with a higher pay grade than myself. But I do think he should have some influence. Because obviously he's being held accountable for the results.
Now, obviously that was a long clip, but it kind of goes into my next question. And we've, I think, gone back and forth a little bit about this on Twitter. One of the things that I heard throughout this entire process was criticism that the governor's intervention in this entire situation was wrongly political and unprecedented. And I put forward several other instances outside the Board of Education where a governor clearly had an influence in getting somebody appointed that was allied to them. Happened numerous times during the Nixon administration. I'm sure it happened during Blunt, Holden, Carnahan, going back to like antiquity. So my question is, why is it wrong for the governor to want to have a say who the education commissioner is, when it's happened in other sectors of Missouri government before?
I don't know that anybody's necessarily saying that. But again, under the law, the governor's role is to appoint the commissioners, period. And obviously the governor's going to want to appoint commissioners that fall – any governor is going to want to appoint commissioners that fall in line with his or her prerogatives. But the point here is not so much about the appointments. It was the appointments have been – they were not confirmed by the Senate. And to take such a drastic action before Senate confirmation I do believe is unprecedented. And I'm sure if you'll be the person to tell me if I'm wrong on that front.
I'm sure that that is an element that – that takes in the unprecedentedness into account.
And second of all, what's the rush? What is the rush? Honestly, what is the problem with making the appointments, getting them confirmed by the Senate, and then going through that process in a contemplative and deliberate fashion? Let the commissioners have an opportunity to work with Ms. Van Dieven and understand exactly how this works. But honestly, I can't think of any job where I would be on the job. In this instance, we had in two separate occasions folks that were literally on the job hours, if not minutes, and taking the drastic action of firing your CEO or your executive leader. That just doesn't happen, and it shouldn't happen. And Missourians deserve better. And it's not about the governor's prerogative necessarily. It's also the fact that I think that at least two members were removed against illegally, you know.
Now, the session's going to be starting in about a month. Do you think that this dispute, I mean, obviously you're a Democrat, so you're not involved in all the discussions, but do you think this dispute might affect some of the other issues that they're going to have to take up, like, real soon, like whether or not if the General Assembly wants to move right to work off of the November ballot, they got to do it really quick? I mean, things like that. Might this whole controversy affect some of that? I'm just interested in your take.
There's absolutely the possibility for, particularly on the Senate side, obviously, for senators to vent their frustration in areas that are not limited to education. I also believe, though, that to think that it would impact something like right to work, I believe that the folks that don't like unions are always managed to find a way to kumbaya on that subject. But there are other subjects that I wouldn't say are necessarily so easily overcome.
And before we get to other topics, I do want to point out that it has been reported in the Springfield News Leader that Senator Gary Romine, a Republican from Farmington, has threatened to filibuster all five of the nominees to the state board. I would not be surprised if other Republicans, especially from rural areas, get involved with that. And I could even foresee a scenario, since I think the majority of the caucus for the Republicans in the Senate is rural.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
That it's not out of the question that these nominees may not have enough votes to be confirmed anyways. I know that's a rare occurrence. It may require some arm twisting, but there may not even need to be a filibuster. Have you heard anything about that? Or I know you're in the House and the Senate is like the Temple of Doom, but I have to imagine that Gary Romine is not the only person who's upset about this.
I would be shocked if Gary Romine was the only person upset about this. So, no, I think that there's every reason to expect that there will be bipartisan opposition to all of these candidates, all of these appointees, I guess.
Now, shifting slightly, because the Democrats in both chambers are so outnumbered, but especially in the House, and it's going to be an election year. And then you've got this stuff as a backdrop, and you've got, as I said, they're going to have to do some sort of vote on right to work early if they want to get it moved, all these things. As a Democrat and as the number two person in the House, how do you see you guys maneuvering at all as far as – or are there things that you're thinking that may be opportunities because it is an election year?
Well, I think that – let me put it this way. I think that there are always opportunities to move forward in a bipartisan fashion. There are always opportunities to work across the aisle to stop or proceed. Charter schools, I think, is sort of a good example. There are many Republicans that are not in favor of it. And we saw that in this year's session, the 2017 legislative session, to the extent that it only passed with one vote to spare. So how that all, works out from a legislative perspective, I think really remains to be seen, and exactly what's going to be pushed and how it's going to happen remains to be seen. Now, from an election perspective, obviously that's sort of a different a different perspective.
Now, on the Senate side, Ron Richard, who's head of the Senate, Republican, has talked about at least having a, quote, discussion. That's how his spokesperson told me yesterday, on any sort of city-county merger in the city of St. Louis. You live in the county. You know this has been a looming issue off and on for decades. Kind of how do you see that playing out right now? There's getting some unrest locally about whether or not the state may try to intervene. I'm just interested in your thoughts.
Well, I can say that the devil in any merger is in the details. It's as simple as that from my perspective. You know, we can talk about some of the benefits. We can talk about some of the pitfalls on a large scale level, sort of a bird's eye view, as it were. But once you get into the weeds, things become extremely complicated. So my hope would be that if there's any, quote, discussion about it, that discussion would be at that level. You know, if you want to have a merger, just think about any department. How does that work now? And again, there has to be a statewide vote for it. So if there's going to be a discussion, there has to be something that goes statewide. If my understanding is we have to change our – isn't it constitutional?
Well, right now there's something in the Constitution right. that lays out the process for the city and the county. Now, if they came up with a plan – I'm throwing this out there – that made St. Louis and St. Louis County one megacity, which I'm sure would stoke oodles of opposition. They could hypothetically put something on the ballot that says, if you vote for this, St. Louis and St. Louis County become a mega city, repealing the thing that's already in place.
Or you mean a mega county.
A mega county or something
yeah,
like mega, that.
Because actually what's been explained to me, and I've been covering this for decades, but this was an interesting angle, is I've been told that one of the complications, even of the city reentering the county, is the fact that the city is its own county.
Right.
And that regardless of all this other stuff, you deal with the constitutional things, basically two counties. Even if they're unequal on many levels, they're still two counties.
So, yeah, my point is it could be done locally. They've tried to do it numerous times. It's failed every time, usually because the county doesn't want to go along with it. And I think the reason the statewide vote is even being discussed is there's this feeling that it'd be easier to pass statewide because people in Pike County and Atchison County don't care about this, so they'll just vote yes, as opposed to doing it in the city and the county. I'm not sure if you've heard that from some of your municipal officials. You are a former municipal official yourself. But what would be kind of your mindset? Do you think this should be only a city and a county decision, or do you think it should be statewide?
I couldn't weigh in on that, honestly, just because I want to know the details before I'm going to vote on something. That's just kind of where I come from.
Yeah.
So I can't even say that I think it's a good or a bad idea. It might be an excellent idea if all of the details are worked out. And it might still be a horrible idea even after all the details are worked out. And my response to the folks in Pike County, though, would be, you know, how would you feel if a statewide if the voters in St. Louis and Kansas City and Springfield and Columbia got to decide if your county was merged with an adjacent county? I have a feeling that at the end of the day, Missourians are going to understand that they're not going to like that either.
And this is another thing that I was at the first Better Together event back in 2013. And one of the things that I believe that they said right away that they were taking off the table is they were not going to talk about consolidating school districts, which I know would be extremely controversial for many reasons. But if you're talking about something that divides the St. Louis region by race, by socioeconomic level, by economics, which kind of ties into socioeconomics, there is no better example of the division than the amount of school districts that are in St. Louis and St. Louis County.
Absolutely.
But I would have to imagine that any proposal that would merge the city and the county school districts into one school district would come up with a lot of opposition, even though it might actually do a lot of good in the end for some of the people who are less well off. I know that's probably not going to happen, but as somebody who knows education policy, what do you think of that idea?
Well, first of all, before Michael Brown was killed, Richmond Heights and Clayton were the only municipalities that I'm aware of in the county that had even bothered to look at the potential of merging from a municipal level. And the school district situation was probably, I would put it in absolutely better than 50% factor in why that exercise didn't come to fruition. And so, I mean, people feel very strongly about where they are in their local school districts, whether they really, really are unhappy or whether they're very, very happy. And in the case of Richmond Heights and Clayton, it was, you know, there was Richmond Heights folks felt that, and this is a quote, this isn't me, this isn't my opinion, this is stuff that was being told to me at the time, was, well, Clayton doesn't want our children. And I actually had a member of the board from Clayton say that Clayton was the Fendi purse and Richmond Heights was the knockoff. And so if you come to the situation, if you come to a discussion from those perspectives, you're too good for us, you don't want our children, and you just want to be like us, it's never going to work, no matter what. Even if voters were to approve it, it doesn't work. Because, you know, you're talking the Sharks and the Jets trying to get together by elective fiat. And I just don't think that – I think that you never overcome those problems.
I mean, one of the reasons that we have such – varying taxing burdens in St. Louis County is really because of the different school districts.
Absolutely.
It's all about the school districts.
I mean, I think anybody who's writing about it, that's the key reason. It's even more than the local governments, because your major tax chunk goes to the public schools.
Right.
Now, I'm originally from a different state, but I spent 4 years in the Post-Dispatch Washington Bureau, and I lived in Maryland. And in Montgomery County, which is the main county that surrounds Washington, D.C., similar to St. Louis County, it's one school district, one massive school district. Now, there was close to 20 different high schools and all these sub-districts within it, but it was one school district, one school board. But the thing I noticed, there was still disparity.
Oh, I'm
right.
sure there
St. Louis
there
public was schools.
Still, there was still disparity where some high schools were considered better than others. And as a result, your property values, you know, were affected by that. So my point being that even having one big school district doesn't always affect – doesn't always correct all the
problems. I think you're absolutely right.
But one thing that I think has been good about Better Together is it has prompted reporters like me and policymakers like yourself to discuss these things a little bit more seriously. And I just mentioned that because – you know, Better Together does have Rex Singfeld behind it, and I think Joe confirmed that in her reporting. And while Rex Singfeld has not always gotten his way on things, he has a lot of money, and he could probably get something at least before voters. Kind of shifting gears a little bit to another thing that might come up next session. We've talked about this with some of our other guests, mainly on the Republican side. Is I do want to kind of ask about what the legislative response to Amendment 2 is going to be. And Amendment 2, for our listeners, is a constitutional amendment that set campaign donation limits within the Missouri Constitution. I think everybody at this point agrees that there are a lot of
flaws,
loopholes, problems with Amendment 2. And out of all the suggestions that have been put forward, you have actually produced, I think, two of the most important ones. One is the fact that Amendment 2 did not really have much language to stop coordination between candidates and PACs. Because right now, you could go to a fundraiser for a PAC that is ostensibly going to help Gina Minton,
right,
say, hey, I think you should give $1 million to this
PAC. Even though technically it's independent.
Just as long as you don't make clear that it's going to help you later. Somebody could give $1 million to the PAC and then eventually help you later.
And the PAC could spend all that on you, and you could still beat that
right
at that fundraiser. And that's legal the way the law is written.
And the other thing is that right now in Missouri, it is very easy for a candidate to take the amount of money in their treasury and give it to a 501c4. I talked with James Clark about this a couple weeks ago, and he said that Missouri statutes specifically say that you can give your money to a charitable organization. 501c4 is a charitable organization.
Yeah, just so our listeners know, James Clark is the executive director of the Ethics Commission.
So those are two things that I think we talked about on social media that maybe I could hypothetically see both parties saying we need to fix these areas. I could also see them being like, no, we don't want to do anything. Let's just leave these gaping loopholes in place. I'd like you to kind of expound upon that.
Well, I think that you're right. Those are both really difficult issues, and they're both big problems and sort of glaring loopholes in Amendment 2, as well as the municipal stuff, which I know we even talked about it before.
Yes, we did.
That was in 2016 session. I remember having that conversation. But as to the coordination, it works to the detriment of the public in a number of ways. One of them is, as we discussed, that this PAC could spend all of its money on me. So there could be a PAC saying, we love Gina Mitten, and I can actually go to lobbyists. I could have fundraisers say, don't give money to my candidate committee, which is Mitten from Missouri. You could give, Gina Mitten's great PAC and give $1 million to it, and then Gina Mitten's great can spend $1 million on my House race in 2018, and that's perfectly legal, so long as I am not coordinating with that other PAC. I'm not saying I want my mailers to go out this day or whatever. That other PAC basically runs the campaign, and all that I am is a figurehead to some extent. The other way that it works out to be problematic is that it's a way to get around the candidate committee to candidate committee donations, which are often used as, on both sides of the aisle to help other candidates become elected. And so it'd be the same situation in that I can have a fundraiser, I invite donors and lobbyists and say, don't give to Mitten to Missouri, give to, it could be called anything. And that's one of the real problems, is that those PACs don't even bear any relationship to the person that's actually directing the donations. And so I could have my PAC could be the Jason Rosenbaum PAC, but in actuality, what that PAC is going to end up doing is giving money that to other House candidates. And I can't say, Jason Rosenbaum, please give $500 to Joe Manis or whatever. But what I can do is put on social media, I think that Joe Manis should win this election. And it, again, it's another end round, and it removes transparency. So I think that sort of the fix to that is to tighten up the coordination laws on both sides of that. In that, I don't think that any candidate or anybody that has a candidate committee should ever be allowed to direct donations to any other continuing PAC under any circumstances. As to the 501c4 stuff, again, that to me is sort of an easy fix, to the extent that you could limit it to a 501c3, which doesn't have the ability to do that political stuff. The other thing is that, look, Democrats, it's not new news to say that Democrats have been hollering about the need for transparency in 501c4s, and it's certainly it been exacerbated since the governor's decided to form a new Missouri and not disclose any of his contributions and where that money's coming from, where that money's going, and really basically running only on the federal level, despite the fact that it's working on a state level. So those are all problems that really – I know that our caucus is putting forth legislation to fix these things. We'll see if the Republicans are interested in working together on it.
And Joe has made this point numerous times, and I've come around to agreeing with this, but – eventually. It took a little bit of prodding. But, I think that the Republicans can kind of like do nothing and just wait for more ballot initiatives to either not really fix the problems at stake or cause even more problems, or they can kind of sit down maybe with Democrats, come up with ways that they feel that they can plug some of these deficiencies in Amendment 2. I've already heard Representative Justin Offerman talking about limiting donations to county municipal candidates, mm-hmm. which we've talked about before. This might be a good instance for them to actually do something, because I know in the past they didn't do anything because they liked the other system where there were no limits.
But then many of them didn't, because they discovered the downside is your opponent could get $1 million check, and all of a sudden – your vote didn't. I mean, we had a number of former legislators
and
on our show.
We could debate that.
Republicans who said they regretted getting rid of
it. And we could debate that into infinity. But as long as Amendment 2 is in the Constitution, doesn't matter. Like, there's going to be donation limits. So
that's hard to get something out of the Constitution once it ends.
Right. Right. And I mean, look, we Amendment 2 was not very well crafted. Amendment 2 was not crafted in coordination with the Ethics Commission, which is a problem, but it's the law of the land, and what 70% of Missourians supported it, and for good cause. And that to me, though, is really what the takeaway needs to be, is that if the majority party in the General Assembly wants to stick its head in the sand and say, we don't have to address this problem, ultimately it's going to be addressed for them. And the problem is that it'll be addressed in a way that doesn't necessarily work. And that, I think, should be the lesson to Amendment 2, is you know, the people are going to make it happen one way or another. And it might take a long time. It might take less time, and depending on the issue. But, you know, medicinal marijuana is a great example of that. It's, I believe, going to come to Missouri eventually. And the bottom line is that should be done at the level of the General Assembly, because then we can craft a bill that actually works in conjunction with existing statute, works in conjunction with our Constitution, works in conjunction with the regulatory boards. So with Amendment 2, we've got an ethics commission that until they're able to really go after some coordination, and I think that that will ultimately happen. The game has just shifted over a little bit, and I don't see it changing.
Do you see the legislature trying to pass its own medical marijuana bill with this new approach Missouri bill looming?
Well, we did. It actually – something did come to the House floor in 2016 or 2015. I can't remember which one. And we didn't get – I want to say it stalled at maybe 75 votes, maybe right around there anyway.
Yeah.
And folks that were proponents of – were proponents of both medicinal and recreational voted no because they didn't feel it went far enough. And then, of course, folks on the other side of the spectrum voted no because it went too far. And that bill was so targeted. I want to say that you had to have a six-month a terminal diagnosis of less than 6 months, and it only had to be cancer. It could only be cancer. So if you had Lou Gehrig's disease, for instance, you still wouldn't qualify, and it still didn't pass. And at the time, there was a petition going around that hadn't gotten the signatures. Eventually, somebody's going to get those signatures.
And the reason I mention that is if the legislature wants any say on where the proceeds from this goes,
right,
they need to get in gear, because if they don't, there's going to be this essentially system, which I believe is a constitutional amendment.
Yes, yes. It is.
That,
see,
directs the money to veterans. Now, I'm not saying veterans don't
of
deserve
course.
Money, but if you want – and it's not a huge amount of money. It's like $4 or $5 million dollars a year. But if they want to use that money for health care, roads, building – I don't know anything other than veterans. They have to get involved here.
But let's get to the heart of this, though. Why are these being done as constitutional amendments instead of statutory changes? Because the Republicans, since they've been in office, has shown time and time again, statutory change is not respected by the majority party in the General Assembly. And that's really, if you really want to get down to the heart of it, that is the heart of things.
So the change after the 2010 were the Humane Society got some puppy mill restrictions passed, and then in 2011, the General Assembly got rid of a bunch of them.
Immediately.
And I'm not saying it was good or bad. I'm just saying it that set a precedent.
And Governor Nixon supported that for various reasons.
Exactly.
I don't want to get into that
and
situation.
And he's a Democrat. And in fact, on Amendment 2, I mean, to be fair, it's not just the Republicans who share some of the blame for this. I mean, former Governor Nixon at the time, a Democrat – I mean, Claire McCaskill, some other Democrats kept threatening to have some sort of initiative petition drive to come up with new campaign donation limits. They didn't.
Right.
So then you ended up with a conservative, social conservative, Fred Sauer, who basically crafted Amendment 2 for his own reasons.
Right.
But the bottom line is, I think both major parties share some of the blame for that.
Let's shift a little bit in our last few minutes to politics a little bit. But before I ask you about how you feel the Democrats are going to do next year, I do want to ask you a personal question. Do you plan on running for House Minority Leader next year? Or is that something that you're thinking about right now?
Right now I'm focusing on what's going to happen in the 2018 legislative session.
Yeah.
So we will cross that bridge when we get to it.
Okay. Well, now that we got that out of the way.
Now we're getting to the bridge.
we're crossing that bridge. You know, it's been interesting that since 2012 – I've even talked to Republicans who have been in charge of the campaign effort, and they're like, okay, this is going to be the year we lose
right.
seats. Or 14 is going to be the year we lose seats. Oh, well, Trump is going to destroy everybody. We're going to lose seats in 16. Last year, the Democrats gained one seat,
yep.
but they're still in a big hole. I think that there is some hope that Trump's approval ratings continue to go down in Missouri, and that helps Democratic cause, especially when some of the incumbents are terming out. What's kind of your prognosis at this fairly early juncture?
It's a tough prognosis at this early juncture because I think that if you'd asked the same thing in November or December of 2015 about what was going to happen in November of 2016, I would suspect that everybody in this room would have been wrong. So With that being said, look, I think that 2018 is an opportunity for Democrats, and hopefully it's gonna work out that way. I do believe that what's happening on a national level is really going to start resonating in ways that we hadn't seen before. I think that once Missourians across the state have to fill out their tax returns, my hope would be that there's a realization of exactly how far they're being sent down the river, so to speak, financially. Anybody that's got their own business that's self-employed is going to be in big trouble, and that includes, carpenters, the folks that come and fix your house, all of that stuff. That is such horrific policy, and it's been supported by Republicans all up and down the spectrum. I think that that is going to be a big topic next year.
But some of the tax implications, most of it won't go into effect until 2019. So in other words, some voters may still see this as rhetoric.
Right.
It kind of reminds me a little bit of the Obamacare debate,
mm-hmm.
where it was very unpopular, and it wasn't until it started going into effect that then you had millions of people who were like, wow, this is better than what we had. So it kind of flipped over several years. Now, I think part of the problem was that the Democrats never did a good job of explaining what they meant. But my point is that the tax thing could run into the same situation where the Democrats could be preaching doom and gloom. And whether that's true or not, the average voter may not really get that until, let's say, after the election 2019, 2020, when they really see what their tax bill is, whether it's less or more.
And I think, that could be a problem. And it'll be our job to try and make sure that message gets out in different ways than it is right now. We'll see what happens.
Now, one of the key things is that this is an off-year election.
Mm-hmm.
Often you don't have – some of the Democrats always have trouble getting their base out. So here you've got, African-Americans that need to be energized. They're talking about whether or not it's going to happen in Alabama, because that's going to be key to whether mm-hmm. or not the Democrat pulls an upset. But here in Missouri, Claire McCaskill, State Auditor Nicole Galloway, they will need a huge African-American turnout to help them fend off strong challenges from Republicans. They will also need a lot of students who may be affected by the tax bill. So as a Democratic activist, how do you do that? I mean, do you think that that's going to be able to be happening? Do you think suburban women are going to come out and back you? Or is there stuff that the Democrats need to do?
Well, there's always work that everybody can do. And I'm not suggesting that Missouri is Virginia. It's not. Okay. But what we saw happen in Virginia is, yes, these people got out. There is frustration amongst the Democratic base. And all that we can do is to continue to work that and to get the message out and to urge people to actually get to the polls. All that I can, go to a Democratic club meeting, one that occurred in December of 2015 and one that's occurring in December of 2017, and you're going to see, A, that they're having meetings, and B, that people are actually showing up. I think that what happened in November of 2016, as far as the Democratic base goes in Missouri, was a big wake-up call. Obviously, it's important to make sure that momentum continues. I think that Stephen Weber has done a fantastic job going across the state and trying to get our message out and organize and getting people together. I was actually just down in the Boot Heel a couple of weeks ago to just a little event. But we're going across the state, and we are letting people know that we're here, we're organized, and we need their help in 2018.
And this may seem like kind of an odd question to ask, but with the setup, I think it'll make sense. So in 2014, I would contend that strong performances by people like Deb Lavender, Jill Shoup, were critical for Steve Stenger to win. In fact, if Jill Shoup would have lost, I think Stenger would have lost too. Now, I don't know if the Republicans are going to field a strong candidate against Stenger. I do know that there's a primary opponent that's planning to spend a lot of money. I know that there are people who are really upset with Stenger, people who are really ready to defend him. With that as a backdrop, how do you think the situation on a county level is going to affect things like statewide turnout? If people are really upset after this Democratic primary for county executive, is it possible that that might hurt legislative races? It could help hurt people like Claire McCaskill and Nicole Galloway? Or is it too early to tell whether that primary is going to be as nuclear as Dooley Stanger was?
I don't believe that primary is going to be as nuclear. That's just my prognostication. But I don't know that, you know, I don't know that that'll hold true. I do think that, yes, absolutely, having a county race that doesn't help bring everybody, you know, that doesn't work together, I guess would be really the way to put it, can create problems. There's no question about that. And that's true in any race. It's just it's no different when we have a presidential candidate than who's on the ballot for president in a presidential year than who's on the ballot for U.S. Senate or for county councilor, for county executive. So I think that those things absolutely have relationships to each other. How that ends up, you know, coming down at the end of the day, again, remains to be seen. And again, as you started this question by saying, you know, Senator Shoup and Representative Lavender being on the ballot was a help. Those same things are also going to be true in 2018. In fact, both of those women are going to be candidates in 2018, and not just them. We're going to have candidates everywhere. We'll see what happens also in the U.S. 2 congressional primary. That could also be a vote getter or will help turnout. And all of those things work together. It's
like a
complicated. It is.
I do just want to point this out as a parting thought. You know, we had Bill Otto on last year, and I actually came away from interviewing him like, wow, this guy is a candidate that's won tough races before. He seems to be working hard. He checks all the right boxes from an issue level. The DCCC completely ignored him. Didn't give him a single set. And now I'm getting emails about how from the DCCC about how bad Ann Wagner is now. You're not a representative of the DCCC. It just seems kind of odd that they ignored Bill Otto in a year where Koster and Kander needed good turnout from that district. And now they're suddenly all on board with it. If DCCC people are listening, it seemed like that was a missed opportunity last year to do what it seems like they're trying to do.
Well, now, although as it turns out, with the massive Trump wave, frankly,
it probably didn't matter.
It wouldn't have mattered. I believe that, but I think that that there is a broader point here. I mean, and we're going to be seeing. I'm really fascinated, frankly, more by this Alabama race than the Virginia race, which the Democrats actually got a bigger chunk than they thought. Because I'm very curious, because the polls are all over the place. Just as a political junkie, I'm just curious, you know, what happens and what that means. And but my one point, closing point, is that women, Democratic women, and not just Democratic women, but also Republican suburban women, I think will be the Republican conservative women, Democratic women, African American women voters. Those, I think, are going to be the key blocks that determine what happens next week? What happens next year? I really do.
I think you're absolutely right. I think, frankly, I would call them the independent women voters, or what's really gonna make the difference. And my Republican leaning friends from Kirkwood gonna come out and vote in 2018? And how angry at Trump are they? Is really what it's gonna come down to, from my perspective.
Well, thank you for coming on our show. I think you actually just picked our outro music, Independent Women by Destiny's Child.
Oh my gosh, I think you did have it.
I think you did. I was struggling with that. And for all of our stories, stlpublicradio.org. Follow me on Twitter at Jay Rosenbaum. Follow Joe on Twitter at
Jay Manis. That's JManNIES.
How would we follow you on Twitter? Any other
part? At GC Mitz.
And here is Destiny's Child to play us out. Until next time, so long.
If you have a smart speaker, you have access to the entire world of NPR and St. Louis Public Radio. All the latest news and all the captivating stories. Activate our voices with yours by telling your smart speaker to play St. Louis Public Radio.